Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to the show. Before we get started here, I just want to say that I am really grateful that you have tuned into this show. I feel so lucky that I get to be a part of making a show about creativity, curiosity, and art, and that each week I get to sit down with the greatest minds of filmmaking, music, literature, acting, and even skateboarding, and I get to pick their brains about their creative process. And most of all, I feel lucky that people like you are listening in and that you're getting inspired and getting motivated by these conversations to make your own art and forge your own creative paths. If Off Camera can play some small part in your creative success, then I have the best job in the world. And I want to keep doing it forever. So that's where you come in. If you like what we are doing here and Off Camera has become something that you look forward to or count on, then I am humbly asking for your help. Here's an easy way to support the show. We just released Off Camera The Portraits, which is a big, beautiful, coffee table worthy 260-page book which captures every iconic artist that has appeared as a guest on Off Camera. It makes an incredible Christmas gift, and if you pre-order right now, you can get a limited signed edition for only $55, which will arrive at your door before Christmas. So visit the store at offcamera.com and pick up a copy for yourself and a copy for your mom and copies for everyone else on your Christmas list. You will not only be getting a beautiful photography book filled with never-before-seen images, but you will be supporting Off Camera. It's a win-win. So, thanks for listening, and now on with the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor and author Octavia Spencer. Pretty early in our conversation, Octavia Spencer told me that she loves a good mystery. Well, me too. For example, how does a dyslexic girl with severe stage fright become an actress and then an author? And when someone close to her told her not to go to Hollywood because it was only for beautiful people, why was she not furious? If you saw Octavia on the screen before The Help, you could be forgiven for thinking she was a nurse. It's a role she's played at least 30 times, and she's a little tired of checking people's blood pressure. The Help brought her to wide attention and earned her an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. And then Hidden Figures came along, which also earned her an Oscar nomination. She was finally telling important, untold stories, but also feeling confined to a certain era and role. That brought up another mystery for me. Then why play a 1960s cleaning woman in Guillermo del Toro's new film, The Shape of Water? Her answer says a lot about who she is as a person and as an artist. Recently, Octavia put some of her hardest work and hardest won wisdom in a kid's detective book, which inspired me as much as it did my daughters. But Octavia has always bet on herself, and that alone is a great message. You'll hear many more in this episode. You'll also hear the only way you'll ever get her to play another nurse, and what you'd better not say to her if you see her in the grocery store. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Octavia.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
It was very nice of you to come all the way to Santa Monica.
Hey, you know, Santa Monica's a place too.
Yeah? You brought us a pie. Do you get the pie thing a lot?
A lot.
Is that the thing, like, when people come up to you on the street, is that the thing that they reference the most?
It is the thing that they reference the most.
Which is the weirdest icebreaker in the world.
It really is, especially if you're, like, grocery shopping, which has happened to me more times than you can ever imagine. The first time it happened, you know, I'm in there with sweatpants, and I'm thinking, I'm going to run in, run out. My hair is, like, you know, a sumo wrestler on top of my head. I'm in giant sunglasses, and I'm checking melons or I'm checking avocado. And somebody leans in and says, eat my blank. And I'm like,
really?
And then you have to like, oh, wait a minute. Because I don't know. People think you're constantly walking around thinking about the help, that you're going to know what they mean. But that's happened a lot. And then you're like, oh, and they're smiling as, you know, with a bit of recognition.
Right.
And I'm like, no,
not
you don't ever go up to a strange woman and say that. Not ever.
Yeah, that's bold.
It's pretty bold.
Yeah. Well, that's a funny thing to think of because, you know, you do this whole career's worth of work,
but you play a part that gets that much attention, mm-hmm. and it becomes like a shorthand for people, right? Yeah. But I guess that's sort of what you're also working towards, right? I mean, better that than the other.
You know, I'm not complaining because I could certainly, nobody could know me or know that line. And you know, there's that. But, you know, I feel grateful to be doing what I love doing, especially at a time when, you know, a lot of people are unhappy. There's a lot of darkness going around right now. So yeah. I get to be happy every day that I get to show up and do what I love doing. I'm yeah. thrilled with that.
Well, I've had a good time this week going through and rewatching some stuff and watching some new things. And one thing I notice in your acting, and I think this is the hallmark of great actors, is that you can form a thought in your head and that thought comes out through your expression.
Oh, thank you.
And I wondered if when you were a kid, if that quality ever got you in trouble.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Oh, honey. My mom, you learn to, the funny thing is, growing up in my house, you have to learn to cloak your feelings and your emotions, literally.
You have to do the opposite of what an actor has to mm-hmm. learn to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I got in trouble a lot with, you know, and then she would, like, I guess my face would be so easily just belying my inner thoughts. And it's like, I'm either going to be angry or I'm going to laugh. And I'm glad that a few times she laughed, you know, and I didn't get into a lot of trouble. But I had to be very, very cautious with emotions.
Did you grow up in a strict household?
I grew up in a strict household. My mom was a strict disciplinarian, thank God.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say thank God?
Well, I look around in the world today and, you know, I grew up Southern. And I just, it's funny when you see kids who, there's no deference to people who are older than them. There's no deference to their own parents. And I look and I'm thinking, ooh. Tantrum. My mom would never, ever allow that.
Really?
All she had to do, if there was a, I don't want to do this.
That was it, just a look.
She would give you a look, and you were like, oh no, oh no. Okay, I better shut this down so we can smooth things over, smile, be bright and sparky and shiny. Yeah, no, she did not play that.
God, you know, I don't know if it's the times have changed or I'm too soft, because I grew up in a very strict household as well. And now with my girls, like, they can walk all over me. Like, I don't scare them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about The Shape of Water, mm-hmm. because it's a crazy film. It is. Guillermo del Toro mm-hmm. made this film, and it's sort of the anti-Hidden Figures in a way, mm-hmm. because it's not the government getting together to do great things for humanity. It's the government at its worst, mm-hmm. kind of, and kind of presents a darker version mm-hmm. of
reality.
Authority and
yeah,
reality.
Yeah.
And, but what I wanted to ask you about was, I read something about the meeting you had with Guillermo del Toro,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered if, you know, because on the surface, okay, you're playing a woman who, she's a cleaning lady, right? Mm-hmm. Like, was it his job to convince you that this was going to be an interesting film and an interesting character? And
well, you're going to be very surprised, because we met, it was a coffee, like breakfast time, and it
right.
was probably supposed to be maybe 30 minutes, and we went into lunch.
Really?
Because we just hit it off so perfectly. And we only talked about the film the last 5 minutes of the meeting as we're gathering our things to leave. And so I think it was more convincing himself that he wanted to work with me, and me perhaps, like, is this a real project? Is it going? And do I want to work? Because you spend a lot of time away from home, and so you want to like the people that you work with.
Where did you film that?
We filmed it in Toronto.
Okay.
And so I didn't know anything about the part. All he told me was, you know, that she was a character who was empowered, and he just wanted to know my thoughts on it. He didn't tell me anything else about it. And of course, I was, the minute they said Guillermo del Toro, because I have seen everything in his repertoire, and I love his work. So I wanted to do it. And I've turned down other cleaning ladies and maids. But what I felt that he did so beautifully, he didn't make it my character playing a woman in the 60s. I played, she will be the third woman that I played in the 60s.
Right, the help and
Hidden Figures. But this, for the first time, I felt like I wasn't playing anything having to do with my race.
Right.
And for the first time, it felt like I was playing a contemporary woman, because all of the things that I talk about are what most people talk about. I was complaining about my relationship and my husband. And that, for the first time for me, felt very contemporary. It was like a breath of fresh air, really.
So interesting, because we've seen you in the roles that you've selected or you've gotten, mm-hmm. but we haven't seen the sheer number of scripts that you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So you maybe have a better or more accurate understanding of the way the world sees you and your role in films.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, was it all the more surprising that was the case? I mean,
absolutely. Guillermo also is a man with an immensely beautiful heart, and that's why it's a strange love story. But there are all different types of parallels going on. The love that Giles and Eliza have as friends. The love that Eliza and my character, we have as friends, the deference that we have for each other that no one else has. You have a black woman who's a cleaning lady, a deaf Latin woman who's a cleaning lady that the rest of the world doesn't see. You have a gay man who's closeted that the rest of the world doesn't see, but we see each other. And we're important in each other's ethos.
Right.
And so the fact that he wrote his two main characters can't talk. And the two people that he chooses to have be their voices, a strident black woman with a heart of gold and a closeted gay man, says a lot about what he thinks about society. And I thought, wow, I had to read it like three times because there's so much going on. The allegorical elements are beautifully and very intricate. And I got to tell you, 98% of the roles that I'm offered have everything to do with me being a black woman. And so I've kind of stopped accepting things that have anything to do with me being black, because if you can't look at me and tell that I'm black, there is something wrong. I hate to have to tell you guys, I'm a black woman.
A black woman.
If you didn't know, I gotta let you in on a little secret. And
Nate's our blind sound man.
Yeah.
So. He should have been in the movie.
You're in on it. You're in on it, sound man. So I'm now just really excited.
I'm sorry he came and touched your face when
it's
you
okay.
got
here. It's okay. But he can tell you that black feels exactly the same as white.
That's right.
Maybe smoother.
Blind sees no color.
Blind sees no color. It feels, you know,
that's
product.
Terrible.
It feels product on the skin.
Yeah. Okay, we got off track a little bit there. But what you say at the heart of that, it may come as a surprise to a lot of people, mm-hmm. because it's easy to also think, okay, you watch The Help and you mm-hmm. watch Hidden Figures and you mm-hmm. go, these are important films to teach people something. In the case of Hidden Figures, I think the fact that no one knew that story,
right.
a black woman didn't know that history and a white dude didn't know that history, that these women helped put men in space. So on that end, you go, well, I want to represent that and I want to tell that story because that's an important part of history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's surprising and notable on the other side. And it's like, I also don't just want to be a vehicle to do those things all
right.
the time or to
right.
be just seen that way.
That's exactly right. Sometimes you just want to, you know, have a heist movie or be in a romantic something and something goes wrong and then you find your soulmate. I mean, so, just irreverent. So the fact that Guillermo wrote this fairy tale with elements about the real world and some historical fictional elements in it. But then he wrote two very contemporary women. Eliza stands up for herself a lot. She stands up for my character. They don't understand what she's saying when she's signing and being,
right.
you know.
And we should say she's played by Sally Hawkins.
She's played by Sally Hawkins, definitely. Eliza played by Sally Hawkins. But she's, you know, she stands up for herself.
Well, I'm curious, when you get the script and she doesn't say anything, How do you as an actor start thinking about, okay, how am I gonna play this? Like, that must have been a bit of a challenge.
I had cold sweats because I learned my dialogue by memorizing it, you know, from cues from the other characters.
That's your process, is to learn it.
Oh, and there are no cues from Eliza.
Right.
So I was like, oh, the scenes where it's just the two of us and I'm basically just rambling on like an idiot, is those were hard to do because you have to learn them so well to throw them away so that they feel effortless and not that you're, it's not that you're not accounting for the other person's opinion, but you know the other person's not going to have a verbal response.
Right.
So it was difficult getting ready for the movie in that regard. And then Guillermo wanted both of us to learn American Sign Language, and we also learned it as it was during that time period.
Really?
So Sally and I were taking sign language classes, and we didn't know if we were ever, how we were going to use our secret language in front of Michael Shannon's character. But then I realized, well, I know that she can hear me. And the only other times that I would sign to her is to say something that we don't want anyone else to know, right, any of the other girls to know. But when you're in front of the boss, you can't really have the secret language. So, you know, I learned it, but there weren't really times that felt organic to use it.
But just the act of learning it, did it give you some sort of, like, did it ground you in knowing who your character was?
It did. She wasn't, I knew my character. I knew her in and out. It was like a breath of fresh air. I felt like she is the child of Minnie Jackson and Dorothy Vaughan. If you just put them together, this is who you have. You have Zelda, because all of those women share something. They live at a time when things are, again, tumultuous is the word that I would use to describe the 60s, and yeah. Well, we're feeling some of that tumult right now in our society. But all of those women had no agency. Do you realize that playing these women at this time, none of them have the right to vote? They have no say in legislation. They have no say in community. They have no say except for whatever happens in their own personal space.
Right.
And so to play a character, I think it's amazing that Guillermo wrote a character that's so carefree, that is, she has a lot of light. And it's not at all about her color. And she's just lamenting to her best girlfriend about the problems with her husband. And I gotta tell you, it's so freeing. It was just like, oh, thank you. I know people are gonna have a problem with me playing a character from this period, but this is a character that I have no problem playing from this time period.
God, it's wild to think that that is so rare for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think, too, that you... I don't know. When I think back over the movie, I can't think of a single instance where race came up. Like the way Michael Shannon treats both you mm-hmm. and Sally, and the way that you're treated as women and as sort of blue collar versions in that area are, mm-hmm. it's oppressive and horrible.
Yeah.
But it's the treatment's no different for you than it is for her.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's why I couldn't believe how he wrote this, and the other, the big other, instead of it being about black versus white versus Latino, the big other is the creature. He's
right.
The big unknown. He's the big, you know. So
well, he's the one that feels all of the discrimination.
Exactly, exactly.
Isn't that funny? I never thought of that, but he's the one that no one cares to understand and chains up and treats like a slave, to tell
exactly.
you the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. So to see all of those elements played out in what is, when you, it's an assault of the senses. I mean, just beautifully, that opening sequence when you're sitting there and everything's floating and it's just like you're in another world. I've always loved Guillermo movies because I felt like he always did something very innovative, something that was unique and only his voice. I think he superseded all of his surpassed everything he's ever done with this one.
I agree. I think it's so beautiful and so its own tone and its own world, and it's a beautiful film.
I agree.
Before we move off of it, I wanted to pick something back up that we were just talking about playing across from an actor who's not using any words. Mm-hmm. Was rehearsal a bigger element in this film than on some of the other films you've been on?
We had 3 weeks of rehearsal because not only did we rehearse with each other, but as you see, Sally's, she's walking and chewing gum in this movie. She has sign language, then she had dance routines, swimming, diving class.
I mean, holding your breath.
All of that stuff that she had to do. So she had her, her rehearsal period was very different from the rest of ours, but we all rehearsed together. Except Michael Shannon only rehearsed with us a little bit because Guillermo wanted to keep him isolated.
Keep him a little scary.
Yeah, but yeah, the rehearsal process was very unique. And we all had our own little pods of rehearsal. The big group, and then Sally and I, and then Sally and Richard, because they had different things that they had to do together. But yeah, it was imperative that we have a lot of time together.
Do you like rehearsal? I mean, is that something that's a luxury for an actor?
The only time that you really get a lot of rehearsal is when you're in a play, which I love the rehearsal process because that's when you discover all of the beautiful intricacies about your character. So yes, I do enjoy the rehearsal process. I don't like to over-rehearse performances. I like the analysis of a script, breaking down a script, walking through some of the scenes, but not necessarily full out performing them, because I think there's something to be said about discovering things when the scene is on its feet.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And something that you may come across that you can't get back later?
That you can't get back. And then you know, if you found something that you loved in rehearsal, and the director says, I really like what you did in rehearsal. When you did, it's like, look, I was in the scene. I don't know what I did. So that's why I'm like, let's not go full on. Let's get up to that point. Let's get up, you know, let's jog. And then when we actually are working, then we can do a full out run. But I'd rather jog and see what's on the trail if I'm going to hurt my ankle because there are pebbles or things. You know, I like to jog a little bit. But in real life, we know I don't like to jog. Okay.
Who likes to jog? Nobody likes to jog.
I'm a walker.
I don't understand people who run. I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
It's just pain with every step.
I mean, seriously.
Is there any insecurity that goes along, though, with that of okay, I'm in rehearsal, and here's the director. If I don't go full out, maybe they'll lose faith in me. Like, do you ever have that fear, like, I'm going to be fired if I don't show them all I got?
I used to, when you first start out, because you only have 1 day or 2 days and that's the other thing, that being on this side versus being back when I first started, you only, as a day player, that's your day. So the director, the producers, no one has time to tell you how to do your job.
Right.
You come in and it's full, you're at 1,000% all the time. And I am at 1,000% when they say, you know, action. I'm at 1,000%. But I'm also, I want to see myself as a piece of soft clay, you know, malleable in that moment, because where you think you might be going, whatever your character's doing, you have to react off of that. So I don't like to have things in my head. I like to know who the character is down to, you know, she doesn't like peanuts or she likes you know, just so that I can be ready to react and live in the moment as it's actually happening. But rehearsal certainly gets you prepared for that, because the more you rehearse, the more you can go home and go, oh my God, I liked this and this is why she did that. I think she did this because of that. So that when you're having those conversations on set, when you're involved in a scene, everything comes from an organic place.
So you're building that as it goes and finding little pieces.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I would wonder about playing a character with the same job as a character you'd played before.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you're a cleaning person.
Mm-hmm.
Is it harder to wipe the slate clean and build an original person when you've played the character?
Well, before? See, I've never played this
played
woman.
Or played the job.
I played the job. Well, I've actually, here's the thing. A janitor makes more than a cleaning lady. See, a janitor makes a by the hour. Cleaning lady makes a flat rate.
So
very different.
So you made that distinction.
Oh, yeah. No, I did all the you know, it's a very different, you know, she's still a subordinate, someone's subordinate. It's still a job that people consider the people who provide that type of work as invisible, unfortunately. But I think it's noble work, especially if you're not, you know, committing crimes. So for me, I played a nurse. I can't even count, maybe 30, 40 times.
Really?
And I finally had to say, guys, no more nurses. Unless she's a serial killer nurse.
30 or 40 times.
Unless she's doing something right. that she's never done as a nurse, I can't do it again. And yeah. then they're like, we'll make you a doctor. I'm like, can we just not make him medical at all? You know? But I chose to do this because even though it's set in the 60s and she's a cleaning lady, she is very different from Minnie Jackson, complete opposite of Dorothy Vaughn.
Right, your mom was a maid, right?
My mom, at one point, that was one of the jobs that she had. She had several jobs that she had.
Was your house spotless?
Yes,
and
she didn't. No, honey, she didn't clean it. We did.
Really?
She's not going to come home from work to a dirty home. No, we did that.
Wow, it sounds like you got your work ethic from her.
I did get my work ethic from her. See, people would say if this whole business, well, actually, it did happen. When our industry went on strike, I went back to a day job.
Did you really? What
did
you do?
I did. I worked at a market research company. I mean, I'm the type of person, I like to pay my bills.
Right.
I like to have money in my pocket. I like to look at you and know that I don't owe you money. And I'm not just sitting around, if I do owe you money, not trying to pay you back. That's who I am. I don't, honey, if all of this goes south, I would not have a problem working in the private sector and a very public job at, you know, some fast food restaurant. It's not who I am. I'm all about being able to do what I love to do. If it still maintained the life that I have built for myself, I'm not above it. I mean, I've always been the type of person who liked to earn my keep.
Just don't get a job at Marie Callender's.
Well, if Marie Callender's going to give me some stock, if she gives me stock and free meatloaf, you know, that I eat meatloaf and pies, I would do it, Marie. And a good salary.
Something's got to go very south for me to show up at Marie Callender's and have you taking my order.
I'll be managing the place.
Okay,
I'm a management type guy.
All right. I read a transcript of a commencement speech that you gave to Kent State University.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking. The fact that you're getting up in front of a bunch of people who are about to start their lives, mm-hmm. right? And the way you sort of structured your speech was you were taking responsibility for hopefully giving them the keys to success or how to make their dreams come true or whatever. And that's quite a responsibility. And I wondered when you sat down to go, okay, I got to write this speech, what did that bring up for you? Like how did you organize that in your head?
It's really, the first thing is to really applaud the effort, to let them know that they've done something that so few people get to do, and that is complete college, and from a great college. You have to allow that moment to sink in that you made a great achievement. But let me just tell you, from my perspective, what you don't want to do. But here's a funny thing. Nobody ever wants to hear what you don't want to do. They want to make their own mistakes. But to me, you know, on this side of things, if I can offer a little wisdom to make someone, out of those, you know, 6,000-7,000 people that were there, if 10 people heard me and said, you know what, I'm going to stop looking at the list saying that Joe Blow, who was also in my class, now he's working for this, that, and the other, I'm going to stop looking at those statements and those announcements because it's making me feel bad. If I can deter that type of behavior and then, you know, just treat it as if you live in a city that has HOV lanes, you know.
Like carpool.
Carpool. If you have carpool lanes, you got to be very careful and pay attention to the carpool lane. If you're over here looking at what's going on in somebody else's lane, you're going to run into somebody in your lane. So if you just stay in your lane, you're going to be okay.
Right.
It's okay to glance around a little bit, but if you're constantly looking around to see what other people are doing, you're going to crash.
That's a great analogy, because I think you're kind of describing sort of exactly what every actor goes through, mm-hmm. because the system is set up to compare yourself to others.
Exactly.
The audition process is set up to compare yourself to others. The typing of an actor is set up that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did that come from hard-worn experience that you found yourself doing that?
At first, but here's the wonderful thing. I'm kind of a rare person in that I knew that I was successful the very first time somebody paid me to be an actor. I'm like, they're paying me to do it! Oh, my God! So I thought I was successful then, and then I knew that I could build on that. And the other thing is, for character actors, it's very different in the waiting room than for lead actresses.
How so?
Lead actresses get into each other's head.
Oh,
and
they do.
Yeah, it's true. They're dressed and they don't make eye contact, or they make eye contact. It's like a waiting room to see a gynecologist, quiet and very sterile. Whereas when you're in a room with character actors, black, white, Latino, it's like you're sitting at sipping a tea at somebody's house, and you get to know each other.
Why do you think that is?
I think the insecurity level is higher because there's a lot riding on whether or not you're going to get that lead role.
Right.
And, you know, for me, I just remember seeing roughly the same group of women all the time. So, you know, if you didn't get the job, oh, well, I like such and such. Rosemary got the job. Okay, great. Okay, Yvette got the job. Great. I like Yvette. And then I got the job. So it was ratio. You would at some point we would all book something.
That's so interesting. I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
When so much is riding on you becoming a star versus you working,
mm-hmm.
the intangibles that make you a star, no one really knows what they are, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
You do find yourself maybe comparing yourself, and
it's really tough. And for me, I have, I was about to say had, but I still have, you know, the same group that we started out with: Melissa McCarthy, Allison Janney, my friend base.
Right.
You know, we just look after each other.
It's hard enough for a white, you know, dude
mm-hmm.
to get work as an actor. It's a high risk, low reward mm-hmm. position to take.
Mm-hmm.
And especially speaking to a bunch of college students who want to go out and try something improbable,
mm-hmm.
right? But then for you, I would think, like, no one is looking at that going, that's a sure bet. That's
honey,
a safe
nobody
bet.
People were, excuse me, honey, you're blocking Halle Berry. Step over. You know, nobody was looking for me. And that's the thing. I'm like, good. I'm glad that you're not looking for me. Because when I get there, you're going to want me. And because you didn't want me before, my price is doubled. So that's good for me. You know, I'm a businesswoman.
Did you have people trying to talk you out of...
Oh, God. I was told by someone very close to me at the time, Octavia, you shouldn't go to Hollywood. Hollywood is for the beautiful people.
You're kidding me.
Mm-hmm. I said,
that's got to feel terrible.
No, I just smiled because I knew in 10 years they were going to try to claim my success, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, what is that, though? Because I'm sure you went through periods of not working and periods of not having money. And what do you think kept you going?
I went through periods of not having a lot of work. But from the day that I said, guilty, guilty, we won, in A Time to Kill, every year I had jobs as an actor. But if I didn't keep my day job, if I didn't keep my work ethic, if I didn't keep a source of income that kept, you know, me vital, you know, then perhaps I would have gotten turned off because I wouldn't have been able to make ends meet. But I kept my day job. I wrote so that I could continue to feel as a creative person, you have to create.
Right.
I worked on my friend's short films. I made myself busy, and then jobs would come around. So failure was never, ever a thought that entered my mind.
It's such a beautiful way to look at it, because I think if you look at it with these stakes of, you know, this expectation that you're going to be at a certain place at a certain time, or that once you have, say, that recurring role for a while and mm-hmm. you finish, if you don't have the stomach to go back to doing regular work, or if you think you should now be somewhere...
Delusional. And you're talking yourself out of your own success.
Right.
So you just never know where opportunities are going to come from. And you have to be proactive in creating those opportunities. Be a nice person. No one wants to work with an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, show up on time. Know your material. Be kind to the crew people, because I can guarantee you they're making a lot less money than you are.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. By working on sets and understanding the hierarchy of things, now as an actor, I make sure I take care of my crew. You know, getting a coffee truck may not mean something to a lot of people, but it says to your crew, I appreciate that you were out there in that, you know, below 20 degree weather with us.
Yeah.
And we're going to get you this hat. It may not mean anything to anybody but you, but we were all in it together. I that's who I am as a person. And I think that's why you love people like George Clooney, because you hear those stories. He takes care of his crews, you know?
Absolutely. You know, and you've been on the other side of it. Because weren't you working for a casting director when you got your first role?
I interned. Francine and I are still friends. She was so amazing because she knew that I was an actor.
Yeah.
And I never asked her to audition for anything because I didn't want to complicate things at the job.
But was it a casting?
Well, when I moved here, I was an intern for her, but I was working for a casting director. She did the location casting and the extras casting.
Okay.
And
for
A Time to Kill. And we did it for other movies as well.
But did you understand that was a smart move to go work in that world? Like, was that sort of a stealth move on your part or accidental?
No, it was accidental. And I'm glad that I did, that it happened for me that way, that right. I was working behind the scenes. That's why, you know, they do tell you, start in the mailroom. That was my mailroom.
Yeah.
Just learning the business that way and understanding it and understanding that every department has a role to play. Every person has a right. role to play. No movie can be made with just actors and directors.
Right. But did you find out kind of at the same time how people are typed really quickly? And
I did.
Like that must have been a hard realization, I would think. Because if the first job you get, you're a nurse, right? Mm-hmm. And you're told you're a nurse. Mm-hmm. Like, how did that go down that you were typed?
It's still going down.
Do you still feel that?
Well, I mean, true. I mean, think about it. There are only a few archetypes that women are allowed to play. And then when you look at my physicality, there are two, really, that people want to see me play constantly. And that's the nurturer or the sassy black woman. So I am like, I don't want to be either one of those in the TV job that I am doing full time. I don't want to be either one of those.
Right.
I don't want to be anybody's nurturer, and I definitely don't want to be sassy. So that, you know, because and everybody wants you to either nurture kids or nurture society. Or I'm like, I have no wisdom. I'm not wise. I'm not wise.
But it's amazing to see that, like, to have your big break happen at the same time that happened, right?
Yeah.
Like, were you told to your face, like, this is what you're good at, this is what you should go for? Or?
No, but you know what I have is I have a really aggressive team, and they know the type of stuff that I want to do.
Right.
So we have been very meticulous in our choosing. If it weren't this Guillermo project, I can guarantee you I probably would never play another cleaning lady. But I wanted this part with this director because he's iconic in the horror genre. And I knew that he was returning to his element, his wheelhouse in The Shape of Water. But we've been very good about not repeating characters and character types.
Right.
And that's hard because they're... The nurses all came before, you know, before we hit that moment of taking us to the next level.
At least you can probably do CPR at this point. Or...
I could take all of your vitals. I mean, I
well,
could.
Well, maybe after the show we'll do that because I've been feeling a little tired lately. Maybe
me too. I actually can't take your blood, though, but I can check. I can check everything.
Okay. All right. Well.
I'll check you out.
Well, okay. So I read something crazy and... I have a hard time believing it, but I've read it in like three different places that you have occasionally intense bouts of stage fright.
Oh, not occasionally. Every time I'm going to tell you a little secret. Not only stage fright, whenever you see me on a carpet, I'm always dripping with sweat.
Like any award show type thing? Premiere?
It's just anxiety. I am a person, I mean, I'm not shy in the sense of I have a hard time talking to people. I have a hard time walking into a very crowded, frenzied situation.
Really?
So whenever I step out of a car and there's lights flashing and, you know, cameras and people screaming, you know, look over here, look over here. My heart just literally starts like, I want to get off that carpet as soon as possible.
Really?
Yeah. And then whenever I have to do any type of public speaking, I'm always a nervous wreck. Until I am out there for at least, you know, when you're on a stage where you're introducing something, a clip of something, you're only on stage for 30 seconds.
Right.
So that first 5 seconds that you're out there, the knees are just like, they don't bend.
And does that also happen in front of a live audience, like say on a stage play?
Mm-hmm. Or? Which is why we don't do, you know, the best money is half hour television. And I love comedy, but I do not love audiences. So Mama has chosen not to do.
So not even a live audience on a sitcom.
Mm-mm.
Forget a theater performance. Because didn't you do a Del Shores play once?
I did a Del Shores play once.
What was that feeling like? Like, is that when you really discovered, like, this isn't working for me?
No, I've always known. I to get scholarship money, I used to do speeches.
Yeah.
And I was always terrified when it was my turn to go up. So that never goes away. I mean, it you control it because you know you have to do your job, but you know it never goes away.
God, it's so funny. It's like hearing from a pilot that they have a fear of flying or something.
I don't ever want to know that.
No, but you know what I mean.
I don't ever want to know that.
Like you've clearly chosen a path for yourself that is riddled with anxiety.
That's so true. I never thought about a pilot being scared to fly. Oh, God.
But, you know, like, there is, to be an actor, to go up, to receive an award, to speak at a college, to mm-hmm. go on stage to play, I mean, those are things that actors do, mm-hmm. you know, and you've chosen, like, even though it's that hard for you. Like, I would be afraid, you know, when you're young, I'd be afraid that you would think, like, oh, this isn't something I should be doing because I get so scared. Like, did you get scared even in school when you were in drama club and stuff?
Absolutely.
So why do you think you kept at it?
Because if you're terrified of everything and you don't venture out and try to get past that fear, you will never accomplish anything, not anything. So when I tell you I'm the most neurotic person you will ever know, I am, and I own that. There's a time that I used to, it would be a great source of shame, but I'm like, okay, I'm a nutball, I'm nutty. That's who I am. You know, before I never had the freedom of saying, okay, look guys, I'm dyslexic, I need the script, I need all of this stuff that they're supposed to give us well in advance of when they want to give it to us. And I'm gonna be a burr up somebody's butt until I get everything, I'm gonna be a burr up somebody's butt. And then when I get everything that I need so that I can go through my process of making sure I know all of the words, all of the intentions that the writer has for the character,
right, right.
Then I'm free to do the job. So whether I'm nervous or not, it's not the problem. If I'm not prepared is the problem.
So do you have rituals even on the day?
Mm-hmm.
When, like say when you're coming to set on Shape of Water or whatever, Hidden Figures, what is sort of your ritual to get you in a place where you can be comfortable?
I'm never nervous on a set because I'm not there to entertain them. If there's an audience there, they want to be entertained. The people who are on the set, they're fixing lights. They could care to. they don't give a second thought to you except what their job is. If their
right.
job is sound, that's what they're paying attention to. If their job is makeup, that's what they're paying attention to. They're not looking at me as Octavia. They're looking at me as an actor that they are responsible for whatever job it is. So
right.
if I'm there to entertain you, I want to make sure you're entertained, which is why I don't like people to visit me on sets.
Oh, really?
Because then you have to be entertained, and I have to take that on. So I don't really like visitors.
That's interesting. Well, you mentioned a second ago that you have dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this to be amazing, too. Again, with the pilot who's afraid of flying, you wrote a book. You
yeah.
wrote two books.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is how I found out about this. I have two daughters who are 10 and 11, and they found your book. They didn't know who Octavia Spencer was. And my first daughter read it, and she's like, this is great, and gave it to my younger daughter who wants to be a writer. She read it, and then she went off and wrote a 93-page detective story. And she wrote it, she chaptered it out, she wrote a whole book. She was so moved by your, and it's this, you write this Randy Rhodes series, and it's sort of like that age of girl, right? Mm-hmm. Around middle school or just before middle school. And they love your books.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and so I started, you know, sort of looking at them because when I was a kid, I loved the Hardy Boys.
Me too.
You
did? I've read every Hardy Boy book.
You're kidding me. And that, I would reread them, and that's amazing.
Every Hardy Boy,
did you do
every
Nancy Drew? Yeah. My sister read Nancy Drew, and I read the Hardy Boys, and imagine my surprise later when I found out they were written by the same person.
I know.
Franklin
right?
W. Dixon wrote
and
the guys,
gave...
and Carolyn Keene?
Carolyn Keene.
Same person.
Same person, yeah.
Okay, so what was the impetus for writing a children's book, or a mystery?
Well, for me, I mean, mystery is a genre that I live in. I mean, I honestly can't go to sleep at night without watching, mystery show, but it's all, usually true crime. But for me, my reading life was saved by my first or second grade teacher. Ms. Bradford was my first grade teacher, Ms. Bradford. And I remember her introducing me to Encyclopedia Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And always telling me that you have to make sure you pay attention to everything because you don't know what is going to be a clue. And so as a dyslexic...
Let me just jump in for a second. That sounds like something you could tell an actor about a script.
Mm-hmm.
Or about the set, or about your wardrobe.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
But imagine, see, what dyslexics, if you have what I call false starts with books, you pick it up and you just can't, you can't break into it.
You can't penetrate.
You can't penetrate it. You for some reason, it's not resonating. Words are jumbling up way too quickly. And then when your brain starts switching things around, you're like, okay, I don't want to do this. But because if you're involved in a mystery, and you know, if things start going south, is what I call it. In my brain, I'm like, I gotta let this ride out because I want to know what happens. And so you stay engaged, and it kept me engaged with the narrative. And so I wanted to put all the things that I loved in one place for kids in the form of mysteries. And for me, I love martial arts.
Yeah.
And that's why they're ninja detectives.
Yeah.
And I love detective work. And I love crime scene investigation. So I worked with a real crime scene investigator to actually do procedural work that we put in the back of the book so that kids could learn how to do a couple of the techniques, like lift a fingerprint or make a cast, a footprint, cast of a footprint.
Right.
But then there are the other fun things like, you know, cooking, because I don't know how to cook, but things that you could do fun with family and friends. So I just combined all of those things that I liked and put it in a mystery novel for kids.
Wow. Yeah, when I hear you saying that, because I don't have dyslexia, so I don't know what it feels like, mm-hmm. but I do know in the people that I've talked to that often they have been mistaken for kids who weren't as smart as other kids, mm-hmm. or they ended up getting in trouble more because of that same thing. They'd have a false start with something, and mm-hmm. they'd be like, screw it, I'm just not going to do it. Did you, like, did reading save that situation for you, or was there a period when you felt slower than the other kids, or felt like...
I never felt slower than the other kids. That's the funny thing. I just knew that there was something going on with my brain and the way it processed information. Because the funny thing is, I was actually tested for the gifted program. They played to my strengths, which, dealing with puzzles and figuring puzzles out. And
right.
I would always be the first one done. And my teacher was happening. You know, you get puzzles as an exercise. And so that played to my strength. Doing mazes, all of that kind of stuff played to my strength. And so I was tested for the gifted program. So my teacher knew that I wasn't, I don't like to use the word, but she knew that I was not a slow learner.
Right.
It was more like fifth or sixth grade that I found out.
Oh, really?
And because you also have coping mechanisms. Because here's the thing, I had my mother. So there was never a choice to not do homework. there was never a choice. If I don't understand, I have to ask an older sibling.
So like, she didn't know you had dyslexia at that time?
My teachers didn't know. My mom didn't know. It took me a longer time to complete homework at home. When it became apparent is when we had to do reading aloud, and I still hate doing table reads to this day.
Really?
I hate table reads. But reading aloud, and I would always mispronounce words, like just say them, if it were evil or something, I would say live, and I'm like, I don't understand what this word is. It's a B. And so she realized then that there was something going on with my brain, not how I, retained information or how I, understood things.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons also that I wrote this book, to tell parents, hey, look, do you know that a lot of creatives, there are a lot of people in this industry who are dyslexic? There are a lot of us, famous people.
Yeah, you do wonder if there's a correlation between thinking outside of a box mm-hmm. and also not understanding the instructions on the box.
Right, and I don't even want to deal with the box.
Right.
Right. But the wonderful thing is, we're visually inclined. And so that's why you have people with dyslexia who are directors of photography, who are directors, for me, the other thing that when there were long periods of time where I wasn't, where I didn't have auditions, I would write to just stay busy and stay creative while I kept my day job.
Does dyslexia crop up with writing like it does with reading?
It does, but it also, the ADD part happens then for me. It's just like in college, if I knew I had a paper, I would procrastinate. I would do all of my research and pile everything up in nice, neat piles. And then I would sit down to write. And just as we're sitting here now, if I see I'm looking down, trying to come up with the first thought of, and I see lint, I would get up. Okay, I got to clean the room. There's lint. Because, I know that my floor, everything has to be in its place. There cannot be anything out of place. And I have to wear shiny rings.
Really?
When I write, because if I'm looking at my hands, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. So shiny, because otherwise I'll zone out and not, it's crazy. It's just how my brain works.
You don't meet a lot of dyslexics who love reading. But I wonder if the mystery novels kind of set you free.
That's exactly. I don't like reading a lot of other stuff. And so I get really nervous when people, I have a script I'd love for you to read. And is it a mystery? Because, I'll read a mystery. But that I can honestly tell you, yes, mysteries are the reason why I love reading.
And they're like, no, it's about a nurse with a heart of gold.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, there's nobody killed her. I don't have to get to figure out who killed her.
Yeah.
I'm not, it's not for me.
Well, God, it's interesting. In the book, Randy Rhoads loses her mom. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that was specific or if that was another.
I lost my mom when I was 18. And I lost my dad when I was 13. And I realized that the faces and compositions of families are really different today than perhaps when I was growing up. And so it was about dealing with loss, because we all deal with loss, and we're dealing with loss at different ages in our lives. So it was about her being a girl and having to deal with her father, who, his job as a writer, writing is also a very solitary job. So now he has to, find time, make time for her, the time that she would have been spending with her mom. And it's all about the growing pains of that and how girls and dads communicate with each other. But also about experiencing loss and talking about that loss.
It's interesting that you would make it the relationship between her and her father when you mm-hmm. lost your own father and didn't mm-hmm. have that relationship.
Right.
Because up until when you were 18, I'm sure you had a really close relationship with your mom, but you didn't mm-hmm. have one with your dad.
I did not have a close relationship with my dad. But see, it's also about, I for me, I'll tell you, because there are a few things that are societal in the book. Because believe me, I got a lot of flack when people say, why is your protagonist a white girl? And I had just read Whoopi Goldberg's ballerina series, and it's all about a little black ballerina. And I've read a few books that had black female protagonists, but never have I seen, and if there's some out there, I need somebody to bring it to me. I've not seen black boys, and I knew that I wanted my story to be about a girl, and because I want girls to know that they can be leaders,
right.
And I want girls to know that they can have power in their physicality with you know, something like Taekwondo. So I said, okay, so I know it's going to be a girl. I don't know if it's going to be a white girl, Asian girl, Latina girl, I don't know. And then I said, wait a minute. I definitely know that it's going to be about a group of three kids, and one of those kids is going to be a black boy. And that way I can get to play his mom in the movie version. But, you know, anyway. But
if anyone's listening.
But then I started thinking about what girl is ever treated like the other, and what girl is ever treated differently because of the way she looks. And I remember one of my dearest friends, a little redheaded girl, freckly, and we used to always talk about her childhood, and I'm thinking, it's going to be a redheaded girl.
You know, that's so interesting that you would look at who's the other, and you would pick a white redheaded girl.
A little white redheaded girl, because they are they're minority. And so and then I rounded it out because I knew the other would be a Latino boy. And so that's why I chose this group of kids, because they each represent other. And when they work together, and one of the kids, the Dario DC, he is hearing impaired, and he's ashamed. Each of these kids is ashamed of something. Pudge is he has a name of a chubby kid, but he's really skinny because he was a fat baby. And now he's really skinny, so he's kind of ashamed of being a very skinny kid. And DC is ashamed of his hearing aid. But Randy's character lets him know that, you know, that's your superpower. You can read lips. You can tell us what those people across the room are saying.
Right.
We can't do that. So it's all about turning your challenges into your super strength.
What was the most unexpected thing that came out of sitting down and figuring out how to do something as monumental as writing a book? Do you like the solitary thing?
I don't. I do and I don't. It depends on where I am in my life. If, you know, I liked it because at the time my day job was constantly around people. So I loved those moments by myself. But here lately, I realize that I've only done outlines and I've actually haven't put pen to paper because it means that I'm going to have to go through my ritual. I'm going to have to make myself sit still.
And you have to put the rings on.
Put the rings on, you know, very Liberace.
Well, it's impressive on a number of levels.
Thank you.
You know, that the thing you're succeeding in is something that terrifies you at times, and the fact that words and literacy, all that stuff, could have been your enemy, and instead you're writing books. I mean, the fact that you're kind of going up to resistance and facing it and going, I'm not going to fall for this is impressive.
Well, the alternative is I will be lying in a fetal position, never doing anything. That's why, I mean, it's imperative for all kids to know that we are all afraid. Everybody's afraid of something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try it. You may not like it. Try it. You may not like it. So you tried it. And what you find is trying or doing the things that terrify you, you definitely feel stronger on the other side. Imagine this. I'm dyslexic. I hate live audiences, but I hosted Saturday Night Live, and you read cue cards, and people are there. It was...
Oh, yeah, that's both of your nemesis, your nemesi, the same time.
Yes.
How did you survive that?
Honey, I think the stress, it was kind of great, because I think I lost, like, 5 pounds in 3 days. It was wonderful. But it was stressful.
The Octavia Spencer diet, just scare the crap out of yourself. Well, listen, it's been wonderful to get to know you a little bit.
Thank you.
And I'm hoping you'll sign your book to my daughters, and I can absolutely. I can bring it home and say, this woman says, do not get out of line with me.
Stay in your lane.
That's right.
I guess kids don't know what that means yet because they don't drive.
No, but it's nice to meet you and, you know, to find out that there's this sort of driving force within you that like these things have happened, not just through luck or not through any sort of accidents. Like, you've pushed this all the way to this point and you have an amazing career.
Thank you.
It's a joy to watch you work. So thanks for coming and doing this.
Well, thank you for having me, Sam. It's been fun.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't yet seen The Shape of Water, it is worth your $12 or $15 or however much it is at the multiplex these days. And if you have a child who loves reading, check out Randy Rhodes' Ninja Detective, because it's a great way to get your kids interested in mysteries and into reading. And it's just a great book. So check that out. And if you're in a book buying mood, well, we here at Off Camera have a book for you. We have just released Off Camera, The Portraits, which is a 275-page coffee table book of portraits of every iconic artist that has been on this show. And not only is it a great holiday gift, but it's a great way to support the show. And you can check out the book right now by going to offcamera.com and going to the shop. And best of all, if you pre-order now, you can get a signed edition of the book. And as a bonus for all of our podcast listeners, if you enter the code OCBOOK at checkout, you'll get an additional 10% off. So buy a book or three, give them to your loved ones for the holidays, or treat yourself, and you'll get an intimate behind-the-scenes look at the show. And while you're there at offcamera.com, you can become a subscriber, which means for $4.99 a month, you can watch every episode we've ever made. That's right, 129 episodes so far that you can enjoy on any device at any time in its entirety just by subscribing. So check that out. And also in the store, we make an off-camera magazine, which you can subscribe to in bundles of 12 issues or as individual purchases. So check that out. And every time you spend money in the off-camera store, you can rest assured that you are supporting this show and keeping it going. And that's what we're all about. We want to keep making this show a long time into the future. So if you like what we're doing, check it out, buy a magazine, subscribe to the show, get a book, and it will help us keep the show going. If you want to reach me and send me a letter, comment on the show, critiques, guest suggestions, or anything that's on your mind, I am sam@offcamera.com. You can also find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. So check that out and tell the world about us and spread the word about Off Camera. I want to thank everybody that helps on this show. This show would not take place without the hard work and the talent of the following people: Crawford Shippey, our producer; Laura Kemper, who runs the studio; Nathan Shields, who edits and does sound; Michaela Galvin, who does graphic design and camera work; Kara Johnson, who transcribes all of our conversations; Amy Jones, who is our writer and proofreader and generally makes us look smarter; and of course Matt Davidson, who keeps the spider webs out of every corner of the office and sweeps up around the place. Matt, thank you for your hard work and for your simple dedication to the show. And most importantly, we are back next week with a very special show. Be sure to join me next time when I sit down with musician, actor, author, punk rock icon, and one of my personal heroes, John Doe.
We did kind of feel that, like, this is not a job for the faint of heart. So I think that's one of the reasons that it never was embraced by the mass media, because it was scary. And it was that people took drugs and people were dangerous and they meant it. And years later, when it's like hair bands and stuff like that, it's like, oh, that's just cartoon shit. That's fine. These other guys, these could be dangerous.
As a co-founder of the seminal LA band X, he shaped and inspired a new genre of music, musicians, and artists bent on doing things their own way. He talks about the non-existent career plan that brought him to Los Angeles and the ups and downs of being in a band that record labels and the media didn't quite know what to do with. He also talks about his solo career and shares some personal background I wish I would have known as a young fan. See you next time, off camera.